leave Drummond free on the outside. Bradley, the former Celtic, drives in and scores.
Drummond, the
get it in for Bradley, and he drains it. Drummond sets the screen. They dare Smith to shoot it from the outside, and he drills it. All the way, Tobias Harris banks it in. Smith early. Inside Bullock, no, but Drummond. Harris floats it up. Drummond lays it in.
When you look at Drummond, you have to worry about him.
Drummond drives in and scores. Tobias Harris going to the rim. They have not been able to handle Drummond or Harris. The Pistons have their way with Brooklyn tonight.
I thought our defense was outstanding tonight. We got everybody doing their job. I mean, we did a very good job on the boards. You know, our challenge is we've done this a lot, right? Come off a bad game and then bounce back. You know, you get beat by 36 by Philly. We come back and beat Houston. You know, we've done a lot of that up and down. The challenge is can we get ourselves ready to play like that on a more consistent basis?
This is 4 years for me since I've been back. And this has just been we have great months, we have not so good months, we have, you know, times where we're not playing well, we have times where we are playing well. This is just us. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde at times, you know, but the potential is always there, and we want to continue to get better every day, continue to learn from each other every day, and we got seven new guys this year.
The Cavaliers are going to be aggressive, and they're in a difficult spot because they don't know whether LeBron James is staying, and they don't know how much of their future they want to mortgage to try to win this year. One thing that is in play is Cleveland's first-round pick this year. That Brooklyn pick, though, they own from the Kyrie Irving trade with Boston. They have not used it at all in conversations for DeAndre Jordan. That'll be a hard deal to do without it. But if they can find a big-time difference maker who they think puts them over the top, then that Brooklyn pick will be in play. But they've got to get better defensively. They certainly have to get better around the rim. They're among the worst in the league at protecting the basket.
LeBron James isn't so very excited about leaving Cleveland. And based on his ability to continue and the organization's ability to continue to put together super teams in the Eastern Conference, makes me feel like he's going to want to stay there. Number two, we've seen this guy be not only a son, a husband, a dad for public consumption, but this also tells me LeBron James wants to stick around the NBA until his son becomes a prospect and actually makes it to the league, which would be so very awesome.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for joining us for the extravaganza. Easy for me to say as we get rolling at 10 minutes after 3 o'clock on this Thursday afternoon. Thanks once again. We've got a very nice show lined up for you. We're going to talk more about the NBA, and we'll do that with our good friend Eddie Meissonette, who covers the NBA for SportsFanJournal.com as well as Fox Sports and others. That'll be at about 4:10, an hour from now, top of hour number two on the program. And then coming up at about 4:40, we will talk more local basketball, college style, with Todd Kowalczyk, head coach of the 10-6 Toledo Rockets. 2-1 now in the MAC as they bounce back from their MAC conference schedule opening loss to Buffalo with a pair of wins. And we'll talk about those wins and Saturday's matchup up in Mount Pleasant against Central Michigan. So Coach Kowalczyk will be joining us. That was a really, really interesting soundbite there. At the end of the montage, excellently put together, as always, by Mr. Cushlin. Jalen Rose saying that LeBron James, one of the reasons, and help me out, Cush, because I you know, try to process these things as they go. Sometimes I don't hear these ahead of time. Is he saying that LeBron James wants to stick around in this league long enough for his kid to become a prospect and maybe do a Griffey type thing?
That's sure as heck what it sounded like.
That's what I heard. You know, I mean, you know, it's weird. We talk about LeBron James all the time and his incredible physical fitness. The fact that, I mean, he really does. It's I don't want to say it's unprecedented but you really have to think about guys who are able to play deep and at a very high level. At a very high level, not just a shadow of their former selves, but at a very high level into their late 30s, let alone into their early 40s. It's very hard to do that. I suppose you could be a hanger-on. Would you say that Ken Griffey Sr. was kind of a hanger-on, if you will, at the end of his career when Junior came up?
I would venture into that territory, sure.
Yeah, I guess that's okay in baseball because you can be on a roster and be an occasional pinch hitter and be a stabilizing clubhouse presence. And if you've got to play an inning or two out in the outfield, okay. And let something like that happen into your older years.
Yeah,
basketball's a different animal.
Yeah, and real quick, to that end, I'm looking up Griffey's senior numbers. Yeah, he took 140 at-bats between the Reds and the Mariners in 1990 and then 85 more in 91. And I think it was in 91 where he and Junior hit back-to-back homers in the same game.
Is that right? Okay. And how old was he then?
He was 40 and 41 in those two seasons.
You can do that a little bit in baseball.
Yeah.
Because, again, the physical demands are a lot less, particularly if you're just a situational guy anyway. And every team has rosters, you know, roster spots for situational guys, whether it be a, you know, righty-lefty matchup out of the pen or whether it be just a pinch hitter slash bench player who gets in once in a while.
You the occasional can DH at-bats if you're in the American League.
But in basketball, that's not a thing, and I don't know that LeBron would want it to be a thing for him. His son is in what, 7th grade or 8th grade, LeBron Jr.?
I forget. It's one of the two. Let me look that up and get a copy.
It's okay. It doesn't matter. It's okay. The point is he would have to then go through 4 years of high school, and that's assuming he develops, and he is. For those who don't know, LeBron James' son is, you know, considered to be, in his age bracket, you know, one of the quote-unquote elite prospects for his age. He is very talented. We've all seen video of him, you know, dribbling and driving and scoring and doing things through the years on YouTube, and LeBron is always promoting and
LeVar Ball talks back about him once, too.
Yeah, right.
Among
right.
all the other things, as we know.
God, don't even get me on that guy again right now. But LeBron is, you know, of course, tweeted things like that, videos out, very proud, as so many dads do. I do, and his son is very good. But let's just assume that his development is the development of a top prospect.
Okay.
Now, mind you, if he's in 7th or 8th grade, then we are talking about 5 or 6 years before he would be able to go to college at all and play your one and done, because you can't come in right away. So now we're talking about 6 or 7 years, depending on whether or not he is a one and done caliber prospect, and depending on whether or not he's a 6th or 7th or 8th grader. Now, let's just assume, for the sake of the conversation, that, you know, he is a fast track boy. He is on that fast track. He is going to be a star going into high school, and he is going to have all kinds of college offers. He can pick his place. And he could play a year and then fast track right in after that. That's 6 years minimum, 7 years possibly.
Yeah.
And that takes LeBron, who just turned 33, into his 39 and 40-year-old self.
Yep.
The question is could LeBron James, being the freak of nature that he is, and it's not, and by the way, you know, everybody knows I'm not the biggest LeBron James fan in the world.
Right.
There are a lot of players in the NBA I like more than LeBron James for a lot of reasons. There are things that just rub me the wrong way about LeBron James. Not the least of which, of course, was 2010 and the decision and the whole nine yards. Some people forgive and forget. I don't. I'm glad he won, helped win a championship for the Cavaliers. It's my favorite team. I cheered it. I cheered them. I cheered probably at points in time during that series. I cheered him, even though he's not my favorite guy. I think it does a disservice to him to say he's a freak of nature, because it's not natural. It's work. Nature may have made him 6'8 and 250, but looking at him when he takes his shirt off after games and looking at his build, that's not nature. That is deep, deep desire. And I give all of the credit in the world to people when credit is due, whether I like those people or not. I've even had to give credit to people in Seattle with the Seahawks, who I despise when credit is due. I don't like LeBron James, but this isn't just some sort of freak of nature. He works his tail off. It's the desire to stay in that game shape, that MVP caliber level at age 33, the same way he was at age 23. Quite frankly, the way he was at age 18. I don't know if he got any MVP votes as a rookie, but he probably should have had at least one or two. Because if I remember right, he averaged like 25-5-5 or something stupid as an 18-year-old fresh out of high school kid. This is pre-one-and-done mandates.
Right.
So I would not put it past him, Jim. It's 6 or 7 years away, 39-40, but if the work that he puts in continues and the body is injury-free, and that's the key.
Yes.
As you get older, you know, everybody blows out a knee, it seems, at some point or another, and they're never the same when they come back. or everybody blows out, in Isaiah Thomas's case, a younger guy, a hip, blows out an ankle. What did Kobe do before he came back as a shell of himself? Wasn't it an Achilles tear?
Yeah, it was the Achilles. I know there was a knee thing involved at one point, too.
But I think the Achilles was the big one.
That was the BS.
And
that
he
was
came
the big
back
one.
Just, he did not have the explosiveness he once did.
Right.
So what makes LeBron James remarkable, though, we must say, is that he has been an absolute Iron Man. I don't know that he's ever missed longer than a two-week stretch of a season at any point in his 15-year career, has he?
No, he hasn't.
He's never suffered an ankle that kept him out longer than that. He's never suffered a knee injury that
right.
6 months or ending a season. He's never had a shoulder separation that cost him, like Kevin Love did, cost him a season. None of those things have ever happened. He has been just an Iron Man. I think he took that two-week break, like two years ago, and if you recall, it ticked me and other people off. Because it was, my back is sore and I have to rest it. And then he's not with the team, but he's down in L.A., or not in L.A., in Miami, hanging out with Dwayne Wade and kind of partying. And it was like, all right, this is just, I want to get away from the team. I think it was David Blatt. Was it 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was the
I think
first
Blatt
season
was still
back.
The coach.
Yeah, it was that first season back. He had that couple weeks off, yeah.
And he didn't want to be around David Blatt was kind of the, I don't know. And that's just, you know, the way the stories went. But beyond that one or two-week period like that, he's never. So anyway, long story short here is you assumed he was always doing all of that hard work just to be what he wants to be, which is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. You assumed he wants to continue to play into his late 30s, putting up the points that he can to chase Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as the greatest scorer of all time, to chase Michael Jordan as the greatest player of all time, all of the things that are within his grasp and within his reach. You just assumed that was the driver. How cool was I want you to play that again for me, Jim, from Jalen. How cool was it, as Jalen Rose kind of explained it, that maybe the motivation is more than just personal glory. Maybe the motivation is better and bigger and more important to him than I want my name to be above Jordan's on the pantheon of all-time greats. I want to pass Goggles Jabbar for the all-time scoring crown. I want instead to be able to line up alongside LeBron Jr. the way Ken Griffey Sr. once did with the prodigy 19-year-old Ken Griffey Jr. Let me hear that again.
LeBron James isn't so very excited about leaving Cleveland. And based on his ability to continue and the organization's ability to continue to put together super teams in the Eastern Conference, makes me feel like he's going to want to stay there. Number two, we've seen this guy be not only a son, a husband, a dad for public consumption, but this also tells me LeBron James wants to stick around the NBA until his son becomes a prospect and actually makes it to the league, which would be so very awesome.
It would be so very awesome. I got to say, and again, not a big LeBron fan. Might be a really big LeBron Jr. fan. I might be someday. He's never done anything wrong that his daddy did. And who knows what kind of a prospect. You know, a lot of guys are superstars in 7th grade and 8th grade. It's different when you get to the high school level, particularly if you're going to be at Akron St. Vincent St. Mary down there where his daddy played, and I'm assuming that's where he will go again. And you're going to be playing the elite schools, not only in the state of Ohio, but, you know, in the region, traveling to different cities and states and playing games against other elite high school basketball programs. Then we'll see. Separates the men from the boys very, very quickly. Remember, Michael Jordan's son never made it. I'm trying to think of superstars' kids who just never lived up to what, you know, perhaps their dads hoped they would be. Pretty much any of them. I mean, honestly, you know, you look at a guy like Klay Thompson. You know, his dad, Michael Thompson, was a big time contributor to the Showtime Lakers, and that worked. But that's not Michael Thompson wasn't like a LeBron to the point where, you know, you expect his kid to be outstanding because he was one of the best players ever. He was a solid contributor to a championship team, but not like that. You'd have to go, you know, Doc Rivers' son Austin is not, you know, tearing up the NBAs in the league. It's hard to find NBA superstars, and I don't have a list of, you know, sons and fathers who have played in the league, let alone at the same time. That's never happened. It's hard to find that list of superstars who whose kids ended up making it to the NBA and making players of themselves.
Not just the NBA, but any sport. I mean, the Ken Griffey Jr. example is probably the best one for Jr. being better than Pops.
In many ways. I'm not even talking about being better than. You're right about that. I just mean making it.
Yeah, making it to the show. That's very true, too.
You know, just getting there. Like I said, I can name a few, you know, sons of kids, but or sons of NBA players. But yeah, it's a great thing to root for. I hope it works out that way. It would be very, very cool. And if LeBron James was still in the league, particularly if he was still in Cleveland and his son grew up in Akron and did the same thing he did, and if he ended up making it to the league and LeBron could play with him alongside him, one day, even for an inning or two. I just went all Griffey. Even for a game or two, you know, and of course it would have to work out that, I mean, if he was an elite prospect, of course, on one and done, he's going to go to whoever has the draft pick at the time. Not necessarily, you know, it wouldn't be a situation where they could just, you know, free agent or yeah, get him as a free agent and say he's going to play wherever his dad is. But, it would just be cool. It's a really neat story there, offered up by Jalen Rose. Okay, that was a little bit more time than I wanted to spend on that, but I just think it is a cool suggestion and a cool idea. Again, for a guy I'm not a big fan of, but maybe whose son I will be a big fan of, I felt like that was worth sharing a little bit more on. Okay, there's by the way, Pistons, you know, it's funny, we sit here and question yesterday Stan Van Gundy in the direction of the Pistons. They go out and have one of their most impressive wins of the year. They blew out the Nets. Not that the Nets are hard to blow out. A lot of people do it on a pretty, you know, fairly regular basis anyway. But they did, so congratulations to Stan Van Gundy and the boys. The Pistons went out and got it done. We'll talk a little more NBA in a bit. Cavaliers have a big one tonight, Jim. Cavaliers have a very interesting matchup. When I say big one, I just mean in the context of, you know, the second-best team in the Eastern Conference right now continues to be the Toronto Raptors. And so the Cavaliers are in Toronto tonight to take on the Raps. And when we say big for the month of January, we just mean it's a testing ground. Because yeah. Cavaliers have been sliding. They are, let's see, losers of 6 of their last 10. The Raptors are winners of 7 of their last 10. They have a 2.5 game lead over the Cavaliers for the second spot behind the Celtics in the Eastern Conference. So a little bit of a showdown between the Cavaliers and the Raptors. Get a little IT against Kyle Lowry going and see what happens tonight. That ought to be an interesting test to see where the Cavaliers are and whether or not they are prepared to bounce back from their worst loss of the season. They lost by 28 points to the Timberwolves a couple of nights ago, and we'll see whether or not LeBron can rally the troops.
Yeah, and that this stretch is an interesting one because it also coincides with Isaiah Thomas coming back in, which means, as we talked about the other day, Bob, resetting of rotations and things like that just when it looked like, you know, right before Christmas, that they had figured things out and they were in a nice rhythm. That's when they were on the, what was it, 21 out of 23 or whatever they had won. And they've been sliding, you know, a little bit since then. And they got to figure out some things, not necessarily in the starting lineup, I think, but other parts of the rotations. Like, you know, for example, I know he's horrid defensively, but then again, so is this team. Well, just one small example that keeps popping into my head. They got to find minutes for Channing Frye. I really, really believe that. And that's just one small example of some of the things they're still trying to figure out. And, you know, it's a tough stretch. And then you get the Raptors tonight. And I kind of posed this question to you recently on this show. And the answer we both agree on is, well, you know, the Cavs have pretty much taken them apart. Won 8 out of 10 playoff games in the last two seasons. But when do we all have to start looking at the Raptors along with the Celtics as possible legitimate threats to the Cavs?
Now, I'm not waiting.
Okay.
I don't think there's a reason to wait, right? I mean, the way I look at it, they are a threat. They're more consistent than the Cavaliers are right now. There's a reason why they have a better record than they do right now. They look like they don't have the chemistry problems the Cavaliers do. When I say problems, it doesn't mean like they can't come together. It's just that, you know, the new faces thing. It's when Derrick Rose comes back, now that Isaiah is here, all of the stuff, it changes the minutes for Calderon. You're right about Channing Frye. One thing that Ty Lue does is he falls in love with rotations.
Yes.
He really does, and he rides them. And if you happen to be at the end of the bench and out of the rotation, you end up spending tons of time there, weeks, if not months, and it's frustrating. And then you don't get guys sharp when you do call on them. He does tend to fall in love too much, in my opinion, with that. So I agree with you. You got to find some more minutes for some of the depth on your bench. The chemistry part of this is going to just take some time for LeBron to figure out how to play, not just for two games with Isaiah Thomas, but LeBron, Kevin Love, Dwayne Wade. You know, everybody has to figure out how to play with him, figure out his style, figure out what he does for 20 games.
Mm-hmm.
And that 20 games might lead to, I don't know, dare I say, a .500 record in the course of the experiment. And I brought this up at the beginning of the whole season.
I was just about to look that up, but keep going.
At the start of the season, it was supposed to be Derrick Rose is going to be the starting point guard while Isaiah Thomas is out, and Calderon is going to be his backup, and Wade was a starter at the time, and, you know, J.R. Smith wasn't, and all these things. I said, you know, eventually they're going to figure all this out now. You know, Derrick Rose is new. Jay Crowder is starting. He's new. Dwayne Wade is starting. He's new. And they're going to have to figure out who should be starting, not just who is starting because of their current, you know, their places on their previous teams. And then they're going to have to find that rotation and live with it for a while and work it for a while. Who's coming off the bench with the second unit? For how many minutes? With what? With which running mates? And so on and so forth. And then, as I said, this is back in October. Once they get that figured out and they hit a stride, and they cross the calendar, you know, calendar flips to the first of the next year, and suddenly here comes Isaiah Thomas ready to play, and now everything that they had found chemistry-wise and everything that they had found, you know, from a rotation standpoint that everybody was comfortable with, it's thrown off. Now Rose, who was the starter, being backed up by Calderon, is a backup himself because here's Isaiah Thomas starting. What does that do to Calderon? What does that do to Rose?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they went with, J.R. Smith to the starting lineup, who, by the way, has been absolutely miserable this season for the Cavaliers. Wade coming off the bench, which seems to work for him. Isaiah Thomas is just a very different dynamic factor than anybody else is. Kevin Love had to learn how to play third fiddle behind LeBron and Kyrie. Now he's got to figure out how to play third or maybe second for, you know, 1B. With Isaiah and LeBron on the court. I mean, everybody has a very long, what will be a long adjustment phase that could be 2 or 3 or weeks or a month long in which the record might suffer. And you say, well, who cares? As long as they, you know, have home court in most of their series, it'll be fine. They'll be better in the long run, you know, when it comes to the Eastern Conference playoffs. But for now, there could be a number of losses piling up for this team as they indeed find out how to play together now that Isaiah is back and has upset the apple cart in terms of minutes for everybody.
And to me, you know, it is easy. Just look back at the beginning of the season, 12 games in, and they were 5-7. The 12th game was that one, again, that they lost, but it was close to the Rockets in Houston. And then starting the very next game is when they won the 21 out of 23 that basically took us to the Christmas Day game, you know, against the Warriors. So that's a 12-game window right at the beginning of the season. For perspective, if you want to make the start point, Isaiah Thomas's return, then we're only 4 games into that.
Right.
So that's 8 games to go before you get to 12 games. And that's kind of my point. It took them 12 games before, you know, earlier in the season with what they had to figure out the rhythms and the rotations. And then once they did, you know, they went off on that run.
They won 18-0.
And the thing a few minutes ago when I brought up Channing Frye, in terms of one of my favorite examples right now of something that needs to be adjusted with some of these rotations is because my philosophy for these Cavs is, look, you're going to be horrid on defense. We all know that. And so just go for the best offensive possible lineups and situations and rotations you can. And Frye gives that better than some of the other guys.
I don't disagree with that.
That's where I bring him specifically up, because I think there are times when I just look at this team, I think, well, I know I'm not going to get defensive, but if he goes out and make a few shots, that'll make up for it. This is an offensive team. And when they're rolling offensively, yeah, as we've been seeing, they're going to win games 120 to 115 or whatever. So it'll look awful from a defensive standpoint. But if they get the W's because they can outscore pretty much everybody with that style except the Warriors, then that should be how they should handle it. I'm not saying they should not try and play any defense, but you got to play to your strengths. And this team's strength is offense. And that's where, me personally, I'm pulling for, you know, getting Channing Frye back into the rotation, for example.
I completely agree. And we're going to have to discuss a lot more of this maybe with Eddie Meissonette and see what he has to say.
Yes.
He's an NBA analyst extraordinaire. That'll be at about 4:10 today. All right, we're going to get a bottom of the hour Sports Center here in a minute. But coming up on the other side of that, is it possible, I want to address this story, is it possible that the franchise that hired the first African-American head coach in modern NFL history, a franchise that hired the first Hispanic NFL coach in modern history, the franchise that hired the first female executive in a front office in modern NFL history, Is that franchise really being attacked for being racially insensitive as it pertains to the Rooney Rule when they hired their new head coach? Yeah, they are. It's a staggering development, and I think we should talk about it. The world of culture, the world of politics, the world of race in America, and intersecting with the sports world once again in a very, very odd way. I want to get your take on it, and you'll get mine, too, as we continue after the bottom of the hour local sports center, which comes your way after we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings, Wild Stat of the Day. Talking about the Pistons' demolition of the Nets last night. Andre Drummond had himself a ball game, 22 points, 20 rebounds, 5 assists. Third time this year, he has gone 20-20-5. The only other player in the league to do that is Boogie Cousins, who has done it three times as well. The game is also marked last night, the 16th career game of 20-plus points and 20-plus rebounds for Drummond, most in the NBA since he came into it in the 2012-2013 rookie season. That is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Well done, Andre Drummond, quickly becoming one of my very favorite NBA players, especially because of what he did with his free throw work. All right, I'll tell you the story about the franchise being accused of circumventing the Rooney Rule despite a history of advanced, progressive, diversified hires. That story coming up as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling right along at 3:41. Thanks for being with us right here on the extravaganza. Eddie Meissonette joins us to talk NBA, maybe a little college football, too. He dabbles a little bit in that for Fox Sports and for the Sports Fan Journal Online as well. So we've got that coming up at 4:10, and then 4:40 we will talk to Todd Kowalczyk, the head coach of the UT Rockets. So I want to talk a little bit about the Oakland Raiders for just a moment or two. On Tuesday, they had their big press conference unveiling what everybody knew was coming, which, of course, is their new head coach, who is their old head coach, Chucky. John Gruden has returned to the Raiders. It was a remarkable get, only because everybody's been trying to get Gruden for the last 9 years that he spent in the ESPN and ABC broadcast booths, doing his Gruden quarterback camp, doing his work on Monday Night Football, and everything else that John Gruden does. And he's excellent at, by the way. He's really a TV star, such a great personality, such a, so famous for that staccato delivery of his, you know, the way he talks. And it's just really, he's really great at it. And that's why he made so much money at it, which is why he turned down so many opportunities to come back and coach in the National Football League. Over the last 9 years, every coaching opening, people said, can we get Gruden? How many times, Cushlin, did the Browns, in changing coaches from, you know, Cornell to, I don't even know the order anymore, really. Seriously, I don't.
I know.
Right? It's stupid. Between Cornell and Shurmur and Chudzinski and Patton and, I don't know. Did I miss any? I don't know.
You probably did, but it's all good. And the answer seems to be after every coach.
Right, but you know, he's got a little bit of ties to Northeast Ohio, does Gruden. So some people said, how about it, could the Browns possibly get Gruden? But he's been linked to every job, because everybody, it's kind of like shortly after Bill Cowher retired. It's like, will Cowher come out of the broadcast booth to coach this team? Will they coach that team? And everybody wants the hot TV guy who's a former Super Bowl winner, right? So everybody has wanted John Gruden, and finally somebody got John Gruden, and that is, of course, the team that really gave him his start, hiring him as a largely untested 34-year-old at the time. I mean, it was a pretty big gamble when Al Davis hired John Gruden. He rewarded them with a couple of tremendous seasons, going to the AFC Championship game in back-to-back years, being denied a spot in the Super Bowl, as we know, by the Tuck Rule and so on and so forth, before eventually being traded to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for 2 1s and 2 2s, and he promptly won a Super Bowl with a team that was largely built by Tony Dungy, but not able to be brought over the hump by Dungy. So John Gruden is the man, and everybody has wanted the man since then, even though he finished his career in Tampa Bay with a few really ignominious years, just, you know, average records and barely over 500 and not anything to write home about after that. So point to all of that is he's been in demand. And everybody knows if you can get him, it's a great get. And you're not going to want to hire anybody else but him if you can get him. Especially in Oakland, where, again, he's enormously popular with the Raider fan base from his previous tenure. And the fact that the Raiders organization in 2 years is going to Las Vegas where they need rock stars. I mean, you want to make a splash.
I was just going to say that part. Yeah, they want somebody to give extra legitimacy when they finally do move to Vegas.
No doubt about it. I mean, talk about marketing, for crying out loud. John Gruden, Chucky in Vegas. I mean, it sounds like a stage show at the Mirage or something. I mean, really, it's like that. So the point being that if you can get John Gruden right, all other possibilities are out the window. You don't have to vet this hire. You don't have to, well, let's do our due diligence and interview five people and see if he comes out as the best. He's the best. He's what you wanted. You're going to give him $100 million for 10 years. It should be the end of the discussion. But alas, this is 2018, and due to various social justice concerns, it's not the end of the discussion. The Fritz Pollard Alliance is calling on the NFL to investigate. They want to open a probe into whether or not the Raiders violated the Rooney Rule when they hired John Gruden in this way. Fritz Pollard Alliance counsel Cyrus Merry and N. Jeremy DeRue issued a statement yesterday expressing concern that the Raiders owner Mark Davis came to an agreement with Gruden before the team interviewed any minority candidates. Oh, lordy, 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 lordy. The Rooney Rule, as everybody who's been paying attention for the last decade or so knows, and I don't even know how long, it's been more than a decade probably since it came into a being, but the Rooney Rule requires every NFL team to interview a minority, for at least one minority, for any job that comes open in the areas of head coach, offensive or defensive coordinator. I don't think it applies to special teams, but offense, defense, coordinator. Because that's generally the pipeline to getting an NFL head job.
I.e. the top jobs on a coaching staff.
Right, the top three. And then I believe the two top front office jobs. I think you have to interview one for your general manager or team president, or maybe three, maybe player personnel director. I'm not 100% sure about that. It doesn't matter. But that's the rule. And the idea, of course, is to try to integrate more people of color into those positions, which have been largely dominated by people who are white. It's always been a very confusing thing to me because they have never, ever been concerned about integrating more people who are white into the players' positions, which are predominantly owned by people of color. It's always been just, it's a meritocracy. You're either better at something than the other guy or you're not. And if it happens to be that 75% of the league is African American, 75% of the players who are the best players are black, well, that's who they're going to hire, or in this case, draft or sign when it comes to players. But in the front office, it's no, meritocracy doesn't work. It's got to be a certain amount of diversity. Okay, fine. Sometimes, by the way, it works out really, really well. Because as we all remember, the Pittsburgh Steelers, after Bill Cowher retired, were all set to hire one of their two longtime coaches who worked on their offensive staff. They were either going to hire Russ Grimm, who was the offensive line coach, or maybe Mike Mularkey. And they had to obey by the Rooney Rule, ironically named after Dan Rooney, of course, is the former Steelers president, who was the one who came up with the idea. And they did so following their own advice, and they interviewed Vikings assistant coach Mike Tomlin. He blew them away in the interview, and they hired him instead. Well, super. It worked out well for them. But here's the question. In this particular case, is there any reason whatsoever for the Fritz Pollard Alliance, or for anybody else, if you're a part of some sort of a group, organization, advocacy group, or whatever, to question the motives of the franchise that has been at the forefront of diversity hiring for decades? Decades! Here's the story. The Raiders owner, Mr. Davis, son, of course, of Al Davis, Mark Davis said Tuesday, introducing Gruden, that he believed Gruden was all in to take the job during a meeting they held on Christmas Eve. Davis fired Jack Del Rio a week later after their last loss of the season, last game of the season, and then officially hired Gruden on January 6. Raiders general manager Reggie McKenzie, who, by the way, is a black man, said Tuesday he interviewed two minority candidates before Gruden's hiring became official. Those candidates were Oakland's tight ends coach Bobby Johnson and USC's offensive coordinator T. Martin. That would certainly have met the criteria of the Rooney Rule. Before Gruden's hiring was official, however, Fritz Pollard Alliance chairman John Wooten told ESPN he trusted that Davis and McKenzie had followed the Rooney Rule, which requires the teams to interview at least one minority candidate as part of the open process. Wooten reached on Wednesday night, referred questions, however, now to Cyrus Mary, general counsel for the Fritz Pollard Alliance. Mary told ESPN, quote, "Let's just get to the facts. If the facts end the way they seem to be right now, then I have full confidence the league will take appropriate action against the Raiders because they care about the Rooney Rule being a success as well. The facts matter. Fairness matters. Fairness means fairness to Mark Davis and having a fair process, but also fairness as far as guys being able to compete with an open process and not a closed process." Davis said he had been pursuing Gruden since taking ownership of the team from his late father, Hall of Famer Al Davis, 6 years ago. And again, as I mentioned, teams have been looking for John Gruden for 9 years, really, since he left the Buccaneers and went into the broadcast booth. Well, maybe eight. Maybe they, you know, he sat for a year before people said, okay, we got to get Gruden. Anyway, for someone to say, Mary said, to say for 6 years, when you are done broadcasting, we would love for you to compete here for a job as coach of the Raiders, that would not be a violation of the Rooney Rule. If in December Gruden says to Davis, hey, I'm going to come out of the broadcast booth and I'm going to coach again, that is not a violation of the Rooney Rule. But if in December Gruden and Davis reached an agreement, not necessarily a written one, but a verbal one, that Gruden was going to coach the Raiders, then after that they do those interviews with minority coaches, that would be a violation of the Rooney Rule. Now, I'm looking at this and I'm just saying, you know, talk about picking nits. Talk about looking for reasons to be upset. Talk about just looking for trouble to be trouble. That's what this is. Because first of all, again, John Gruden has been at the top of everybody's list, no matter who they interview as part of the Rooney Rule, for really almost a decade. If you can get him, every other bet is off. It's just that simple. And quite frankly, there's nothing wrong with that. There really isn't. Again, because I don't know how I feel about the affirmative action process of NFL hiring anyway. I don't know if this is a necessary thing anymore. It's kind of like we've talked about in the past with black quarterbacks. Nobody looks at Teddy Bridgewater and says, well, he's got a nice arm, and he seems to have good accuracy, but you know what? He's black. I'm not sure if he can play the position. Nobody does that anymore, right? Nobody said that about Deshaun Watson. Nobody said that about Cam Newton. Nobody said that about Jameis Winston. And on down the line, people just say you can either play the position and you can't. And they look at your on-field performance, not the color of your skin. And I promise you, there will continue to be more and more growth of black quarterbacks and no more questions about these kinds of things because it's a different time. Do we really have a need for this must interview a minority candidate for these jobs anymore when owners want the best people? They want to win. Now, I can promise you this. Jimmy Haslam didn't hire Hugh Jackson because he was black. He hired him because he figured this is a guy who's a really, really well-respected, established offensive coordinator, and I want to win. I'm not trying to satisfy some diversity requirement by hiring Hugh Jackson. I want the right guy. I'm still baffled as to why he kept him, but that's another story for another day. Same thing with the Lions. I am quite certain they didn't hire Jim Caldwell because, well, he meets the diversity quota here. It helps the league have more black coaches. No, we want the right guy. And guess what? When they fired him, they didn't fire him because, well, we don't really think the black guy can do it anymore. You know, after all, he's a black guy. No, they said he just isn't the guy to take us to the next level. We want the next guy, the right guy. And if the right guy is the white guy, then let it be the white guy. And if the right guy is the black guy, then let it be the black guy. So that's just a general statement on the need for these things. But now to the more specific and personal nature of this. The franchise that the Fritz Pollard Alliance is coming after here, looking for to the NFL to open an investigation and possibly sanction them for violating the Rooney Rule, is the Raiders. Al Davis, who owned the team for so many decades, seemingly like 10 of them, which is not real, but he just looked that way, even up to his passing. Al Davis was a pioneer in diversity hiring. Again, not for the sake of diversity, but for the sake of getting the right person. He made Tom Flores the first Latino head coach in NFL history. Tom Flores. Listen to that last name. Yes, a Hispanic man. And he won two Super Bowls with him. He made Art Shell the first black head coach in the modern era. You think the Raiders, and being run now by Mark Davis, his son, do you think the Raiders have any problem hiring minorities? And as long as we're on it, we'll talk about minority in terms of sex. Because Amy Trask, who was the club president when Al Davis owned it for several years, she was the club president when I worked for the Raiders. I got to know her very well. Super, super impressed by her. Quite frankly, I had a deep respect and a little bit of an intimidation of her. I was a little intimidated by Amy Trask. You talk about one tough executive. I don't care if her name is Amy or Al. I don't care if she was female or male. She was good. Honestly. There was nobody who was a better negotiator. There was nobody who knew. I don't want to say nobody because Al Davis knew a hell of a lot about football, but nobody else in that organization knew more than Amy Trask did about everything from on-field X's and O's to players' qualifications and skill set and draft status. And I mean, honestly, she was brilliant. And they hired her even though nobody else had a woman working in their front offices. Isn't it strange that the Raiders get a chance to get John Gruden, the team that everybody wanted to get? It was a fight to get him they've been trying to get him for 6 years, and the Raiders, of all teams, really, really at the top of the list when it comes to with the advancement of minorities, whether they be Latino, whether they be black, whether they be female. I mean, who the hell knows what comes next? But they are so out in front of all of that, and now they get a chance to get John Gruden, and they're saying, you didn't interview those black guys early enough in the process. You interviewed them after you kind of already knew you wanted Gruden, therefore you violated their opportunities to get these jobs. I got news for you. There is no way in God's green earth, T. Martin, nothing against T, by the way, but T. Martin, the offense coordinator at USC, was going to beat John Gruden out for that job if they had interviewed after one another. Kind of thinking that one was not going to work. And I will tell you this, too. Existing Raiders tight ends coach, Bruce Johnson? What did I say his name was? I don't know him, and I apologize for that. Bobby Johnson. Pretty sure that a guy whose name I don't know right now, who's the tight ends coach, is going to get that job over John Gruden. They could have interviewed Bobby Johnson and T. Martin before John Gruden and said all three of them are in the open process. You're not getting that job. John Gruden was in demand across the National Football League, everywhere probably except for New England for the last 9 years. I mean, literally, everybody else would have traded their coach to get to him.
Maybe Pittsburgh.
That's why
I put the qualifier maybe on that one.
Yeah. Although I got to tell you, as much as I like Mike Tomlin, and I like Mike Tomlin a lot, actually. He's really one of my favorite people to listen to at press conferences and at interviews. He's just a cool guy. I kind of dude I'd like to just have over and have beers and watch games on TV on Sunday with. He's just cool.
I can buy that.
He's fun. Maybe I wouldn't want to do it in my house. I'd want to be at a bar because he'd be able to cut loose a little bit more. Just a fun dude. Anyway, I like him a lot, and I also like what he has done. He's won a Super Bowl, and he's been to a Super Bowl and lost a Super Bowl. But the guy is very, very good, but yet despite that, and I'm getting off on a tangent here, I feel like the Steelers, who have had maybe the most talented roster in the National Football League collectively over the course of the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, has really underachieved. He has not gotten them past Belichick in January. He has not been to the Super Bowl enough times based on the talent that he has. I mean, the big three for Pittsburgh is light years ahead of the second place big three, and I don't even know who that would be right now when it comes to quarterback, running back, wide receiver, the way it used to be with Aikman, Smith, and Irvin. And, you know, you have that perfect balance. The Roethlisberger, Bell, Brown group damn well better win a Super Bowl, and soon, for this to really not have been wasted. And Mike Tomlin, I think, is going to have to, you know, answer those questions at some point in time. So maybe. But the point is, John Gruden has been in demand by everyone. The Raiders finally got a chance to get him. The Raiders, who have been the most progressive organization in football when it comes to diversifying their hires, not for the sake of diversity, not doing it as affirmative action, but finding the right people and being damn good at it. Damn good at it. Like I said, Flores. Oh, and by the way, their general manager right now is a black man. They hired Reggie McKenzie, and he's one of very few black general managers. They have been so far out in front of doing these things for the right reasons, not for affirmative action reasons, and for them to be questioned now because they didn't interview these two black candidates in time. They might have already had a verbal, you know what, we want you, John, do you want to come? And John said, yeah. To me, it's just absurd. All right, you want to speak on it, you can. 866-240-1065. Top of the hour, local sports center coming your way now. And after that, we talk a little NBA, maybe a little college football, too, because he dabbles in that side of the sports world as well. Eddie Meissonette, a good friend from L.A., will be joining us to talk about all of the above. He's with Sports Fan Journal Online as well as Fox Sports, and that'll be coming up after our Top of the Hour Local Sports Center, coming up now right here on The Ticket.
Leave Drummond free on the outside. Bradley, the former Celtic, drives in and scores. Drummond, the get it in for Bradley, and he drains it. Drummond sets the screen. They dare Smith to shoot it from the outside, and he drills it. All the way, Tobias Harris banks it in. Smith early, inside Bullock, no, but Drummond. Harris floats it up. Drummond lays it in.
When you look at Drummond, you have to worry about him.
Drummond drives in, and scores. Tobias Harris going to the rim. They have not been able to handle Drummond or Harris. The Pistons have their way with Brooklyn tonight.
I thought our defense was outstanding tonight. We got everybody doing their job. I mean, we did a very good job on the boards. You know, our challenge is we've done this a lot, right? Come off a bad game and then bounce back. You know, we get beat by 36 by Philly. We come back and beat Houston. You know, we've done a lot of that up and down. The challenge is can we get ourselves ready to play like that on a more consistent basis?
4 years for me since I've been back, and this has just been we have great months, we have not so good months, we have, you know, times where we're not playing well, we have times where we are playing well, so this is just us. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde at times, but the potential is always there, and that we want to continue to get better every day, continue to learn from each other every day, and we got seven new guys this year.
The Cavaliers are going to be aggressive, and they're in a difficult spot because they don't know whether LeBron James is staying, and they don't know how much of their future they want to mortgage to try to win this year. One thing that is in play is Cleveland's first-round pick this year. That Brooklyn pick, though, they own from the Kyrie Irving trade with Boston. They have not used it at all in conversations for DeAndre Jordan. That'll be a hard deal to do without it. But if they can find a big-time difference maker who they think puts them over the top, then that Brooklyn pick will be in play. But they've got to get better defensively. They certainly have to get better around the rim. They're among the worst in the league at protecting the basket.
LeBron James isn't so very excited about leaving Cleveland. And based on his ability to continue and the organization's ability to continue to put together super teams in the Eastern Conference, makes me feel like he's going to want to stay there. Number two, we've seen this guy be not only a son, a husband, a dad for public consumption, but this also tells me LeBron James wants to stick around the NBA until his son becomes a prospect and actually makes it to the league, which would be so very awesome.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
There it is, and it rolls on now at 4:12 right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Hope you're having an outstanding day. Really good conversation. Hour number one, let's get it launched now NBA style with maybe a little bit of college football mixed in because they cover a little bit of everything out at the Sports Fan Journal online, thesportsfanjournal.com, and the editor-in-chief of that outstanding online publication, as well as contributor to Fox Sports, Eddie Meissonette, joins us now right here on The Ticket. Eddie, for the first time in 2018, thanks for joining us, man. How are you?
My resolutions for 2018 are to be 1% more truthful and nicer to everybody. So it is good to talk to you, my brother.
I like that, my man. I like that a lot. Although I don't know you to be untruthful ever. So how you gonna increase upon 100%?
I mean, look, here's the thing. Sometimes you have to tell people what they need to hear so that they can keep going on with their lives in a pleasant and prosperous way. So I will say that I'm around 100% with my life.
That's fair enough. I can respect that, my man. All right. Eddie, let's dive in. Before we get into the NBA, and I really want to talk a little bit about what Jalen Rose had to say at the end there. We were talking about that in the first hour, about LeBron James and LeBron James Jr., which is just kind of cool. Talk a little bit about the championship game. Was that the best final you have seen? You know, it's weird. Last year, when Clemson beat Bama with Deshaun Watson just putting on the cape, man, and just supermanning his team to the championship, throwing that touchdown pass to Renfro with 1 second left, I thought it was the best championship game I'd ever seen. Rivaled, if not surpassed, the 2006 Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush versus Vince Young showdown in the Rose Bowl. Then this year we have the double overtime Rose Bowl with Georgia and Oklahoma and the comeback win there. And then we had this one, man. Can you rank that championship game and that amazing comeback led by a true freshman, Tua, whatever the last name is? He's just first name basis Tua now. The three touchdown passes in the second half, the stunning comeback. Was that the best one that you have seen?
I don't even think it was one of the two best games we saw in the playoff this year. I don't think it was that tremendous of a game. I think it had a lot of thrills, and it definitely was entertaining.
Yeah.
But I thought my takeaway from that game was that I thought it was one of the more mismanaged, most shenanigan-filled games for a national championship I'd seen in a long, long time. I thought Georgia got extremely tight. I thought outside of the 80-yard bomb that they threw to Mecole Hardman, Georgia did absolutely nothing in the second half. And that play could have been taken away if he stepped on the line, who knows, to the end of time. I thought Tua Tagovailoa. I practiced. Tua Tagovailoa was he, you know the phrase that they use, they say when you're so young and dumb you don't even know any better. I thought that's what Tua did in the second half of the national championship. I thought he played ambitiously awesome, and he got away with some mistakes, and he made mistakes. And I thought what Saban did, I think it took a lot of courage to make that choice. And he has that benefit of that five-star lurking in his back pocket. But I thought I didn't think he put on some mastermind performance. I thought that they kind of took advantage of Georgia's failings and slowly and surely just kind of crept their way ahead. And they did make some big plays, but they had some lucky plays too. And I don't want to take anything away from how much fun I had, because I was OMGing my life when Tua hit that throw at the end. But I didn't think it was an exceptional game from a skill standpoint. Last year, from a skill standpoint, was incredible. The talent in that game from last year was incredible, and same with the Rose Bowl a decade ago. This game is going to go down as one of the biggest OMG like things that ever happened. But from a skill standpoint, I wouldn't rank it that high.
I wouldn't rank it that way either from a skill standpoint. When I say greatest game, I think the word you used early on is the one I'm talking about, and that is most exciting, most jaw-dropping, most oh my god, most Georgia has them bottled up. Georgia has their number. The Alabama offense can do nothing against them. And then to blow a 20-7 lead, the way that they did, and to have it blown the way it was, that Saban makes the master stroke of saying, Jalen, love you, bro. You're 25-2, but we can't run on these guys. You don't throw very well. I've got to pull the trigger here. And then it works the way that it did. And then to have the miss to end regulation, the field goal, what was it, 39 yards? They set it up right in the middle of the field for the kid who just, snap hooked it and sent us to OT. There were just so much. And then to have Tua get sacked on first down, taken out of field goal range before he threw that strike to another true freshman. That's what I mean, my man. Just number of, oh my god, heart-stopping moments that didn't just happen. That's how I value, or how I measure the value of a game when we talk about greatest games.
Yeah, what was funny is I thought somebody on Twitter made a really excellent point, and this will speak to the demographic of people listening to the show who happen to play PlayStation and college football or Madden. When you get sacked, and sometimes when you're playing a video game, you get sacked in the video game, your irrational move is, we're going to run a Hail Mary. We're going to run four verticals. And that's what Nick Saban did in a national championship, and it absolutely worked. And it was and I thought the assessment that I've seen from some people, some football analysts was like, that was a rookie passing decision that was exceptionally executed and mismanaged by the safety in the play. And I think to that point, it's like sometimes when the skill isn't as high, it doesn't mean that the fireworks and the hijinks can't still be just as incredible. And I thought that's what the game was, because my jaw, like you said, my jaw dropped when he hit that bomb to win the whole freaking thing. It was incredible.
Four verts. That's what he did. He ran four verts. And but a great throw, by the way. Not just for the throw itself, the touch, hit him right in stride, but the veteran, you know, 15-year veteran NFL presence that Tua, who had never played a meaningful snap all season in his true freshman year, had. To look that safety and cover two off, to keep that head snapped around, looking right, drawing that safety to his left, just enough to know that if he makes this throw, he cannot get back over there to help over the top, and that throw would work. That's the kind of thing that veterans do, that freshmen thrown under the spotlight for the first time in their entire college career in the national championship game in overtime. You're just not supposed to do. You're not supposed to make that throw. You're not supposed to have the wherewithal to read the defense, look that guy off, and make that. I just was so impressed by that kid, by Saban's decision there. Very, very gutsy. And Jalen Hurts, major props. That cat isn't going to go down as the quarterback who won the championship game, but he had every bit as much to do with this national championship because he quarterbacked them to 12 wins. He was the guy. That 25-2 as a starter, without him, they're not there. And he was such a good teammate, Eddie. I just can't say enough about it. And I know we're 4 days old on this now, so I apologize to anybody for being repetitive. But the great, you know, teammate that he is and was, that he was the first guy sprinting onto the field to go hug Tua when he made that throw. The fact that he huddled with him off the field during every timeout and every change of possession. I don't know. A lot of cats would have just kind of hid in the corner a little bit, kind of bummed. I just got pulled from the championship game. It's embarrassing on national TV. And instead, he was just the ultimate teammate. And I just, you know, all those things make it a great story for me. So,
I was just going to overlap and say, like, I think he handled it a lot better than I would have, for sure, and how a lot of people would have. And I think what's fascinating about Alabama now, and I'll close on this, is that it's amazing how Jalen went from looking like a top-tier day one, maybe first-round draft pick under Lane Kiffin, and then Lane leaves, and he looks like an LSU quarterback. And I don't mean that in any way, shape, or form of a compliment. And so it'll be interesting to see what he does next because, I mean, you know, I'd love for him to maybe go down with Lane to FAU, but, like, I think Jalen still has the ability to be an NFL quarterback, maybe not a starter, but it still feel like he has a path to get there. And it's just amazing how the quarterback position at Alabama, which has been so devalued for so long, is now actually starting to look attractive by one half of football by Tua Tagovailoa.
Yeah, and I don't know what Nick Saban's going to do, but I have to believe when spring practice starts in, what, 2.5 months or whatever it's going to be, I feel like the first guy to walk into the huddle has got to be Tua. And it's really, really sad and bad for Jalen. It's life, though. You know, it's just sometimes it's life. If you feel like your offense is now two-dimensional, whereas with Jalen it was one-dimensional, because Tua is a great runner as well. Very strong. Some of the escapability he showed in breaking tackles, in the second half on some of those scoring drives. I feel like if you're more two-dimensional with this cat than you are with Jalen, then you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe Jalen ought to move down to find Lane again or put in those transfer papers because I think he may have just been squeezed out of the job.
Indeed.
All right, let's get to the NBA. Eddie Meissenet is our guest. He is the editor-in-chief of Sports Fan Journal Online, which is thesportsfanjournal.com. He's also a contributor to Fox Sports, Slam Magazine Online, and many, many more. But let's talk basketball now. Big one tonight in the Eastern Conference because the Cavaliers are just in the middle of what I think I and so many others absolutely knew they would be in the middle of, and that is a new chemistry development period. They found a way once Derrick Rose went down and they moved Dwayne Wade to the bench. They found a way to get that chemistry with Calderon playing the significant minutes at the point, and everything was going great guns. They won 18 in a row, and now IT comes back, and the minutes are different. The rotation is different, and they started this little losing skid, losing 6 out of 10 before IT came back, but I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. Because you have to rebuild chemistry with a new rotation. And if Rose comes back and wants minutes, it's going to be another adjustment they're going to have to go through. But they're going to face tonight the Raptors in Toronto, who are just going great guns and pushing up on the Celtics for the best record in the Eastern Conference. How do you see tonight?
I see tonight as a tale of two teams that are playing basketball for totally different reasons. I think the Toronto Raptors are playing an 82 regular season to try to capture the margins of what they need to have for ultimate success in the postseason. And for them, that means they need to do everything in their power to get home court advantage, to have their team feeling fully confident and knowing what their team is going to be, and having controlling the margins of what they can control, home court, giving the young players confidence, things like that. The Cleveland Cavaliers are using the 82 games as more of an exhibition to get their own chemistry right, because no one controls the margins better than LeBron, Raymond James. and Cleveland has to go through the 82-game exhibition season to fully understand who they are as a team. And so them being a 2, 3, 4 seed is really, it doesn't really matter to them nearly as much. Of course, they'd like to be ranked higher. But I think that's what you're going to see in this game, is you're going to continue to see the experimentation of Cleveland. I think that they are weighing what they're going to do within the trade deadline with the Brooklyn Nets pick, what they're going to do with Tristan Thompson, Iman Shumpert, and players like that. So I still think that Cleveland is just going to continue to be a work in progress, and that there are going to be times that if the game is close, LeBron's like, okay, let's see if we can try to actually win this thing. Whereas I think Toronto is in a position where they're going to try to put their pedal to the foot down the pedal and see, can we gas these boys out and let's see if we can get a big win? Because they need Toronto needs the confidence boost. Cleveland doesn't need anybody's confidence boost. Cleveland just needs to finish the 82-game regular season unscathed so that they can try to go to do work in the playoffs.
Yeah, you don't think Cleveland needs a confidence boost from time to time? Because when they're in these kind of doldrums the way they are now, and they've lost 6 of their last 10, I hear the annoyance in LeBron James' voice when he talks to the media. I hear the annoyance in a lot of guys' voices. I hear Ty Lue, who doesn't like being questioned, although I think he has a lot to be questioned about. We were talking about this earlier, about how much he falls in love with certain rotations and sticks with them way too long, even if they have proven to be beyond their use. I don't think they are just, you know, in exhibition mode here. I think they want to win games like this. And I think if you were to ask LeBron, even outside of the presence of a microphone, if he wants to beat some of the top teams in the league, like Toronto, he's going to say, hell yeah, we're going to bring it.
Yeah, and like, I don't want that to be twisted into that they don't care about winning. They absolutely care about winning, and I think that they can show that, hey, like, when we need to step up and we need to win a big game, they can do it. But I also think that they are fatigued, because this is, for LeBron, this is year 8 in a row where they are making this push towards a championship. And Ty Lue is dealing with it. Ty Lue has never known a life where he is not in championship contender mode and dealing with more egos, more veterans, more personalities than what he has to deal with in Cleveland. And so, you know, LeBron's always going to want to shine, but I also think that LeBron has the best 30,000-foot perspective on what he is as a player and what this team is. And so he doesn't have any problem at least being honest. But I think he's also just very aware of, like, hey, man, it's not April. And so I'm not going to sweat it that much. I'm going to give it all I got in this game, and I hope these guys do too, and hope we can kind of continue to evolve and get better. But that is the perspective that they need, because they have so many parts. They have to figure out what they're going to do with Calderon, with IT, with Dwayne Wade, what they're going to do with Jeff Green and Tristan Thompson. We ain't even talking about Derrick Rose. We're not even really talking about Iman Shumpert in that way. So in some ways, they have options. And in other ways, it is up to Lou, LeBron, and the leadership at large to figure out who are the guys we're really going to be able to go into battle with. And today is going to be a training exercise into who are the guys we're really going to be able to trust when we have to go into battle.
Any more insight based on your observations on LeBron James' future destination? People continue to talk about he's more likely than ever, at least based on recent events, to stay in Cleveland. The situation in L.A. looks like a mess. And I'll ask you about LeVar and Lonzo in a minute. But any more thoughts on that? Do you think he's still most likely to stay?
I think staying home is the betting favorite. I think the exercise of trying to go on NBA 2K and trying to make the salaries match on where he could go, because we know what LeBron wants. He said he wants to win, and he's not sacrificing any money. And that pretty much eliminates 85% of the league. I will say one team that is really intriguing and who could potentially, if they finagled their roster in a certain way, is the team that they're playing tonight in the Toronto Raptors. Toronto has always been the team that is, we are one piece away from being championship ready. We've been saying that for the last 7 years about the Toronto Raptors. It was Serge Ibaka at one point. It was, you know, Damari Carroll at another point. You know, it's always been like a new player that's like, this is the piece that's going to make us one piece away. And like, they're always away. Well, one piece could be legitimately LeBron James. And now, of course, they probably have to move off of Valanciunas. They probably have to consider moving off of Ibaka. They might even have to consider moving off of Lowry. I don't think they'd move off of DeRozan. But my point is simple in that Toronto could be a destination. Do I think the percentage is high? No, but this is a fun exercise. I mean, we've entertained the Philadelphia 76ers. We've entertained now the Toronto Raptors. I think the Miami Heat is a legitimate contender because they are a team where they have a piece in a guy like Dragic, but they have young pieces. They have some guys that are movable, and LeBron has a relationship with Pat Riley, and so I think Miami could be a good destination. Where better than South Florida? A lot of other people like to retire in South Florida. Why not LeBron, Raymond James as well?
Jalen Rose said something on the broadcast yesterday, and I think this was from yesterday. Kush found that audio, and we played it at the end of our montage. You may have heard it at the top of the show, or top of the hour, Eddie Meissonette. And Jalen says LeBron is staying in the shape he's in and plans to play long enough so that he's still in the league if and when his oldest son, LeBron Jr., is a prospect and able to make it to the show. I think he wants to pull a Griffey thing and line up alongside his son one time. Now, his son is in seventh or eighth. I'm not sure. Do you know which one LeBron is in right now?
I think he's getting ready. He's getting ready to be playing AAU ball now. So Bronny Jr. is, I believe, 13 to 14 years old.
I know he's 13 or 14. I'm just wondering what grade in school, if he's 7th or 8th grade.
That I cannot confirm 100%.
Okay. The only reason I ask is because that means in either 6 or 7 years, if everything went perfectly, he would be a one-and-done kid ready to come into the NBA. And that would be the perfect scenario because LeBron, 6 or 7 years from now, is 39 or 40. Do you think it's realistic? Any chance? I mean, first of all, the odds of anybody make it to the NBA we know are long, long, long. But he is considered to be one of the top 13-year-old prospects in the country. And if he develops and if he grows and if he becomes what, you know, it takes to be an NBA player right out of your first year in college, the earliest he could get there would be 6 or 7 years, depending on whether he's in 7th or 8th grade. So do you think it's realistic for LeBron to hope to line up alongside the boy just one time?
I actually do. I think it actually is realistic. I think LeBron has shown that his game can manifest itself into a 37, 38, 39, 40-year-old player. I think his mindset of what he is as a player will have a lot to do with that. And I also think, to be honest, like where his business endeavors sit at age 37, 38, 39 and how they are continuing to manifest themselves into what they are will have a lot to do with that as well. Am I excited about the scenario? Like, I don't know if I actually have a lot of excitement about it. I mean, to be fair, like, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey Sr. being out there is great, but like, I don't necessarily remember any of the moments other than when both Jr. and Sr. hit home runs in a game. Like, that was pretty cool. But I'm pretty sure I think Senior hit like 220 the rest of the season. And so what I don't want to see
is... I'm not suggesting LeBron would be, you know, still averaging 25 points a game then. But what made Junior and Senior Griffey happen and make it cool, in addition to back-to-back home runs in the same game, was just the hug, man. When one walked from center to right, you know, Junior walked from center to right, and they met in right center and hugged one another. Just one of the coolest freaking things ever. They played together, and I just loved every second of that, and I think it would be the same kind of moment. I don't care if LeBron is just coming off the bench and giving you 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes in spots at that age, or if he's still LeBron, for crying out loud, he is physically freakish. Maybe he's still doing some things. But just if they had a hug and one passed to the other for a dunk, it would just be amazing.
Yeah, it would be really cool for sure. And look, I think that LeBron has a game that's actually similar in some ways. I can't believe I'm going to say it, but to Kareem, in the sense that there is going to be enough that I think he's absolutely going to be able to still be extremely functional at an older age. Now, the bigger question is actually in this scenario, not LeBron James Sr., but LeBron James Jr. Will he have the skill and the ability to show himself that at age 18 he can be a one-and-done player and actually get to the league? And so we're still 5, 6 years away from that. So, look, it's a pipe dream. It's not a dream that's extremely likely, but if it does happen, trust me, Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat and Facebook will all be prepared to capture all the moments so we can cry. Because I'm not crying. You're crying. I'm not. It's going to be a crying scenario in my household, possibly. It's going to be great.
All right, I think you're right. I think a lot of people would. And I'm not a LeBron fan. But I think that would be unbelievable. I might be a LeBron Jr. fan because I think LeBron Jr. might be a nicer dude. But that's a different story. I'm going to root for that kid. No matter, and I'll root for that moment. I don't care. I will root for that moment, and it will be amazing. I hope that happens. Okay. Now, that's one kind of father-son relationship. Let's talk about another. You're out there in L.A. You've heard it all. Even from Lithuania, LeVar calling out Luke Walton. Nobody wants to play for him. He's lost the team. He's the reason for this losing streak, blah, blah, blah. Magic Johnson need to shut him up? Does Lonzo need to shut him up? And how much damage, if at all, maybe you see this differently, Eddie Meissonet, how much damage is Dad doing to his kid's career with these histrionics and all of the stuff that we knew he would do?
I don't think, my personal belief is I don't think it's doing any damage to his son's career. I do think it's showing a type of defense system that the NBA coaches show that is not all that dissimilar to, I believe, what Dan Le Batard even said on his show, was a bit of a pack mentality, kind of like the police department will have, where they will protect each other at any and all costs and all measures, to the point where now they are coming out and saying that we are going to sanction our media appearances if a media entity, a journalistic media entity, keeps discussing the father of one of the players in the league. And to me, it sounds, on the face of it, it sounds absolutely absurd, on one hand. And on the second hand, I would say that the Lakers don't seem to have any, they don't seem to be complaining about the issues of managing LeVar and Lonzo in that scenario. Yes, Luke Walton is having to answer these questions, but he's making pithy jokes about the scenario. And the Lakers have instituted some rules about the managing of parents within the media, and what they're now calling the LeVar Ball rule. So, I don't personally think it's an issue. I do think it's an overblown issue, and I think it's actually funnier to see the analysis and the insight that's coming from coaches and the media at the aftermath of all of this, even to the fact that we're talking about it right now. Therefore, it becomes nothing but entertainment for you and me, in my opinion. So, you know, at the end of the day, Lonzo is showing that he's limited in year one as a player, and my only hope and dream and ambition for him is that he continues to find more ways to ball out, to get his jumper consistent, because I promise you, the better he plays, the less LeVar will be an annoyance to people, and he'll be actually probably more fun and theatrical for the people, in my opinion.
Does he need to rebuild that busted shot or just tweak it? Because I feel like, you know the game. If you're missing long and short, it's generally a good miss. You know, it's an acceptable miss. If you're missing left and right, it's a bad miss. You're all over the damn place. And because he shoots across his own head, he's missing left and right on a lot of those clangs that he's throwing up there. Does he need to get with a shooting coach and rebuild that whole daggone thing?
If I could wave the magic wand and make the decision, I would absolutely be like, yes, change the shooting form. However, I think of shooting forms like throwing motions, and I feel like once you get to a certain point of development, there's no coming back. There was never going to be a change in Phillip Rivers' hitch in his throwing motion. There was never going to be a change in Kenny Smith's hitch in his shooting motion, or Bill Cartwright in his shooting motion, or Sean Marion in his shooting motion. The point is, and the only thing that people care about is, does it actually go in?
None of those guys have shot
30%. I agree with you, and I think the added challenge is that Lonzo is in Lonzo in the NBA two decades ago would be probably a better shooter, because he wouldn't be expected to do certain types of shots and to carry a team a certain way. We are in a ball dominant point guard scoring mentality era that we have never seen. And Lonzo has grown in that, and we praise him for being an unselfish player. And yet Lonzo still has the pressure to probably put up 12 to 15 shots a game and to get those threes up, because if you can't shoot, then you're suffocating the offense, and then that becomes a bit of an issue. And so I just hope that, and I believe that, the more comfortable he gets in the league, and he has shown some ups when he's had some good stretches of games, and then he kind of comes back down. I think he's going to be able to improve his shot, and I think he's going to tinker with the mechanics of the shot. I think he's always going to have that roundabout wind up motion. But I think if he can get to a point where he's comfortable, because to me he just hasn't always looked comfortable. And half the battle in the NBA is getting comfortable, and no rookie really is ever comfortable. Even Donovan Mitchell, as great as he's played, he still had some really terrible shooting games. But, I mean, when you dunk on people, that always makes people forget about things. And so the rookies, including Lonzo, their shooting is going to to improve over time. So I'm just, you know, that, and I think that's the only bad thing that about that's happening with LeVar and Lonzo is there's this expectation of do it right now. And being in Los Angeles, being in that spotlight with LeVar, the only thing that I think we have to preach more than anything else is, yo, this is only 35, 40 games into Lonzo Ball's career, and he's only a year removed from college, 1 year in college. So there's still a lot of time left.
I still think the kid needs to tell Pops to shut his yap. He's hurting him. You know, I mean, this isn't high school. You know, he's trying to get Luke Walton fired. It's one thing to get the coach of Chino Hills fired. It's another thing to try to get the coach for the franchise where you claim you want all three of your boys to play together. And by the way, one of them is not good enough, and the other one, he may be wrecking him altogether by sending him to Europe instead of to high school for another year and to college. But you know, if I'm Lonzo, I've got to go into that locker room and look at my coach and talk to my coach. As my dad is saying, he's lost him, he's lost me, he's lost all of us, and all this garbage. I don't see how this doesn't hurt his career. I respect your opinion. You laid it out very well. I just don't see how it doesn't. Teammates are going to look at him and say, man, why don't you tell your pops to shut up? Kyle Kuzma, you can tell Kuzma is a leader on that team. He is not taking that stuff. He's speaking out publicly and saying that guy's wrong. I just feel like no matter where Lonzo is, if dad is always over the shoulder barking and causing trouble, it's not just going to be a cute little entertaining annoyance. It's going to be a flat-out disruptive, cancerous effect for the kid, and I don't think Lonzo deserves all that.
I will say as a final counter is that you have not transcended into an elite superstar Lakers player until you or someone in your facility has decided, I think we need to get a new basketball coach. And I'm pointing at Irvin Magic Johnson and Kobe Bryant. Now, if it's deserved with Lonzo, of course, like that's a different scenario. But it would not be the first or the second time.
But my man, the difference, look at the two names you just said. Magic Johnson can do that to Paul Westhead. Kobe Bryant is Kobe Bryant. He can do that. This is Lonzo Ball, who isn't even doing it. It's LeVar. It's Papa that is doing this. So it's so, no, my man, Eddie. No, bad comparison, man. No. This is totally
what's wrong with being ambitious? And nobody ordained Lonzo Ball like Magic Johnson did. So I mean, look, I understand your side, and I'm not even saying I agree that the player should be helping facilitate a coach getting fired. All I'm saying is there is a past precedent of this happening, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I understand, and that's fair enough. There is. In a very different sort of way, there is that kind of precedent. Eddie Meissonette, read him online. You can find him at thesportsfanjournal.com, Fox Sports, Slam Magazine Online, and on Twitter always as well. Eddie, really appreciate your time, man. It's always fun talking hoops and more with you. Have yourself a great rest of the week, and we'll catch up with you again down the line.
Hey, you boys be great. Take care.
You too, man. There you go. Eddie Meissonette, good dude. Very good dude. Joining us from L.A. Very, very busy. He's got his finger in a lot of media pies, and we always appreciate when he squeezes us into his schedule. Okay, 4:41, a little bit late for our bottom of the hour Sports Center, but it doesn't matter. Jim Cushion can still do this thing. We'll get that going, and we'll try to get a couple of calls in before the top of the hour and drive time right here on The Ticket.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And we do indeed roll onward now at 4:47. Thanks to Eddie Meissonette talking a little NBA with us. Now to get back to the college game, we say good afternoon to head coach Todd Kowalczyk, who, of course, is the coach of the Toledo Rockets, 10-6 now, 2-1 in the MAC. They face Central Michigan coming up on Saturday looking for their third straight conference win. Coach Kowalczyk, good to talk to you. How are you?
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Outstanding. Appreciate you joining us as always. And congratulations on bouncing back from a conference season opening loss to Buffalo to get a couple in a row that you really wanted to get. So let's talk about those. Let's talk about Akron and let's talk about Western Michigan before we get to the Central game. And take us back to the 67-65 win over the Zips.
Well, I thought that game was a tale of two halves. I mean, I think defensively we played really well, you know, in both halves, but offensively, we played at a high level in the first half. We made shots, didn't turn it over. In the second half, you know, I was not displeased at all with how we played. We were 0 for 8 from 3. We missed several wide open threes. If you make two of those or three of those, it's a different story. We don't have to grind it out. But I was really proud on how our guys stayed positive, stayed together, and grinded out a tough home win against a team that, you know, Akron, they're not the team they had been in the past, but what they do have is two guys that are unbelievable shot makers, and they make tough contested shots.
And no question, Jalen Sanford had himself a ball game there. He scored 22-40, including what ended up, I guess, being the winner with 13 seconds left. Talk about his contribution.
Well, he's been playing well for us. You know, even consistently, he's been, you know, really solid defensively. He's rebounding the ball better. His turnovers are way down. And he's a guy that just, you know, when he's aggressive, can really make shots and make plays. He made big plays down into that game. They made two huge buckets that we needed.
Now, significantly more impressive was the 84-61 blowout win over Western Michigan on Tuesday night. Tell us about that.
Well, they're obviously a talented team. You know, yeah. Thomas Wilder is considered an NBA prospect, and he's a tough cover. He had 18 points at halftime, and we tried multiple different things, you know, defensively on him. But I thought we played, you know, we had an 8-point lead at halftime. Maybe should have been more. Jalen missed a layup, you know, going into the locker room at halftime. We put us up 10. But I thought we, you know, from start to finish that game defensively, we were sound, and offensively, particularly in the second half, we played at a high level.
Yeah. And offensively, you got a lot of balance too. Fletcher had 21. You got 16 out of Jalen. Another strong game from him on really good shooting as well. 6 out of 9. 13 from Jackson, and off the bench, Kanapke with 16 points. So that's always key, obviously, when you can get some good contributions from the Pine.
Well, we got guys that can make shots, you know, and when you put, you know, 4 or 5 guys in the floor at one time that can make threes, that's a hard team to defend.
Well, 56% in the game from three is pretty. 57% overall, and 56% from three. You're right. That is hard to defend. So what is it that you know that gets these guys in rhythm? You know, because sometimes it can be contagious. It's kind of like a baseball team. You know, you get a couple of guys with knocks and you start to feel it, and you string a bunch of hits in a row together. That can be that way sometimes with shooting. Is there one guy that kind of jump starts and everybody falls in line behind, or is it just it just depends on the game, who's in the flow?
It is contagious. There's no question about it. I think you're dead on there. And what I like about it, I don't think we've had a single game yet where all we're on together. You know, Nate Navigato struggled in against Western Michigan. He made 2 threes late, but he was 2 for 7 from the floor, and he didn't make a bucket until late in the game. And then he had back-to-back threes, which gave us a little bit more separation. But you know, that's why I think this team will continue to get better, and hopefully we can consistently get guys making shots.
Rockets coach Todd Kowalczyk joining us for his weekly visit on all things Toledo, and Jim Cushlin is with us as well. As you know, Coach Jimmy, go ahead.
And one of the biggest things, Coach, that jumps out at me for these two games: 65 allowed to Akron, 61 to Western Michigan. That's 126 when you add them together in those two wins. And last time we were talking to you, we were talking about giving up 104 in a single game to Buffalo. Talk to me about the defensive effort in these two games. It's probably not perfect, probably not where you want it to be, but it's certainly improved since we last talked.
Yeah, that's where, Jim, you and I always disagree with this. You always look at the points. I know that's a big factor. I look at the percentages. The points are dictated by the pace of the game. The pace of the game. Not necessarily, you know, if the game has a lot of possessions and it's a fast-paced game, you're going to have more baskets. You know, I look at the percentages, and the percentages would tell you we played better defensively. You know, and obviously the easy thing is look at the points, but the percentage to me are way more important.
Yeah, and I think that's very, very accurate too. And of course, you know, we talked about this just to kind of further that little disagreement or a different way of looking at it. You and I talked about this before a previous game in which we talked about who controls the pace. If one team likes up-tempo and gets running and another team likes to work the clock and really slow the game down and play it possession by possession, who gets to dictate that, the offense or the fast team or the methodical, slower-paced team? And maybe that just depends on who the opponent is, huh?
Yeah, and you can take yourself out of rhythm. I think if you ask most veteran coaches in today's game, you know, who are some of the best defensive coaches over time? One name that consistently pops up at you, Jerry Tarkanian, was a tremendous defensive coach. Tremendous. But you know what? They probably gave up 80-some points a game. But they scored 100-and-some.
Because when I think back at Tark's teams, you know, you don't think of lockdown moments. You think of high-flying, running, gunning, and they're the running rebels. They're not the defensive stopping rebels. You know what I mean? It just kind of flowed.
And Mike Krzyzewski is considered a really good defensive coach. They give up a lot of points, too, not because they play fast. They play an aggressive style, and, you know, they get up and down a little bit. So, You know, Tony Bennett's a great defensive coach, but they also, you know, take 30 seconds off the shot clock every time and milk the clock and play very, very slow. I mean, there's different types of styles, and there's, you know, I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I think they both are very, very effective.
Well, when you talk about, you know, shooting percentage being the real determining factor as to how well you're playing, I agree and I understand that, but I think probably turnovers forced is just as big a stat. Guys over, it's when you get stops,
yes,
no matter how you get them.
Yes.
But if you're turning
them
over, you have a chance to get out and get more runs and get more, you know,
I agree.
And easy baskets. I don't have your team stats in front of me for the season. How is that going? Are you forcing enough turnovers? Do you have goals and that sort of thing?
No, we never really have been, Bob. We're not a pressing team. We're not playing a lot of 1-3-1 zone. The alarming fact for us, not necessarily is how many we're creating, it's how many we're giving up. And that's the biggest problem. We are turning the ball over too much. And that's been an issue for us that we need to correct. Cause we've had too many turnovers, way too many.
Coach, another directional now. This one is Central. They've got 12 wins, more than anybody else in the MAC overall, but just 1-2 in conference right now, three games into the MAC schedule. Tell me about Central.
Really good offensive team, very skilled. They do have 12 wins, but I think you can look at the non-conference schedule as well. They're a team that's always hard to defend because they really play fast.
Well, that'll be the challenge on Saturday as you head up to Central Michigan looking for your third straight win in conference and keep the ball rolling there. You're tied for first place in the MAC West right now with Ball State at 2-1 and Western as well. So, obviously, very early on in the MAC schedule, it'll be great to get another win and make it three dubs in a row. In fact, it'll be what? You're 5 out of the last 6, so it'll be 6 out of 7 if you can get this one. Hey, Coach, I know you only look at the next game. And then you look at the one after that. But we are looking two games ahead simply because I got tickets to give away for the Kent State game. So help me out. Last week your favorite number was 4. What's your second favorite number from 1 to 10, Coach?
7.
Can I
say one other thing, please?
Please.
And then I'm down at WTOL. There's a TV show for Harvey Steele, obviously a great person for this community who passed a week or two ago. And was a huge, huge proponent to donate life. So please spread the word of being selfish and being an organ donor.
Well, thank you for that message. That is a fantastic message, Coach. And now I feel kind of cheap giving away basketball tickets on the heels of that. That is certainly so important. But, no, we will indeed extend that message, and I thank you for sharing it. And just to let everybody know, we're going to give a pair of tickets away right now to the
awesome
home game against Kent State at Savage on the 20th. A couple of road games in between there with Central and Ohio. But we've got tickets to give away, and Coach Kowalczyk called the number. Lucky number 7 will be the ticket winner. Coach, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Good luck at Central. We'll talk to you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Coach Todd Kowalczyk. All right, so he called it. Caller number 7 at 866-240-1065. We'll get those tickets to the game against Kent, 7 o'clock on January 20th. And, Cush, I don't have my calendar in front of me either. Which day of the week is that?
That is a Saturday. So not this Saturday, but
okay,
next
so that's
Saturday.
A week from, okay, good. Yes. So that's a week after the Western game, or Central game.
Exactly.
All right, good stuff. So thanks to Coach Kowalczyk. And again, as he just mentioned, absolutely so important about being an organ donor in honor of Harvey Steele. God bless. And that is a great, great message to send. So I'm happy to extend that as well. All right, that's it. Good stuff from Eddie Meissenet. Good stuff from Coach Todd Kowalczyk. Good stuff from you, Jim Christian. And good stuff to you if you were listening. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon for the extravaganza. We are back tomorrow for another Bite at the Apple. It'll be a free-for-all Friday. And until then, enjoy drive time coming up next. Cushlin in for Miller right here on The Ticket.